From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the cover of City News. On it, we find a drawing of Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren, and she is digging a hole. She's tossing dirt on a sign that reads, "Justice for Daniel Prude." Nearby, we see an RPD badge, as well as a box full of money with the label, "Friends of Lovely Warren." That's a reference to the investigation into the mayor's campaign finances. Editor David Andriotta writes, quote, "When you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you do is stop digging." But Warren has managed to exacerbate her predicament with defiance and deflection intended to distance herself from her crises and the people she wants us to believe caused them in the first place. End quote. Andriotta notes that there is strong disagreement about whether Mayor Warren can weather the storm long enough to run for re-election and win. One of the key questions is whether the mayor was involved in a cover-up or if she really, simply, had no clue what was happening in her own government. On that point, Andriotta writes, quote, "It is inconceivable to many that no one in the Warren administration recognized the significance and potential consequences of Prude's death and had a chat with Warren about the implications." End quote. This morning, attorneys representing the suspended Rochester police officers made their case for why they believe the officers acted appropriately during their encounter with Daniel Prude. Well, this hour, we sit down with the editor of City News to discuss what he's been writing for that cover story, as well as some changes at City. And I even asked you, David Andriotta, what do I call this now? City News? Maybe City Magazine? It looks like it's a magazine.
It is a monthly magazine. City has moved from a weekly alternative paper to a monthly magazine. We anticipate this being the future of City moving forward. You know, that said, things are so fluid right now. There's no telling what the future holds. But as of right now, we are moving forward with a monthly magazine. But of course, we still break news regularly online. We are a digital news outlet, just like any other news outlet out there.
Yeah. So obviously on your website, but even your reporters and yourself, when there is news that's been breaking, I mean, Gina Finelli has done, is just one example, phenomenal coverage of understanding what's happening with the protests in real time. Some of his work on Twitter, for example, picked up and some of it manipulated by national sources. And Gino's been happy to push back on some of that.
We actually have a column from Gino in this issue of the magazine on that episode.
I appreciated that from him. Yeah. I mean, because the whole landscape of reporting is a little different than it was. There's parts of it that I'm a little uncomfortable with. I mean, you and I are probably a little bit more old school than some of the youngs who work with us.
Sure.
And I see the value. But we'll set that aside. We'll talk a little bit more about the future of City and the present of City coming up here with David Andriotta. But I want to talk about your cover story because that is a striking cover. It catches the eye. Tell me about why that's the metaphor you wanted.
Well, first of all, I should commend the artist. His name is Daniel Alsheimer. He's a freelancer. We commissioned him to do this illustration. One of the main concerns for us was that, you know, that the mayor not be caricaturized. You know, political cartoons have a way of caricaturizing their subjects. You know, Donald Trump often has like squishy little eyes and kind of a chubby face and a too long tie. And
a tie that runs for miles.
Yeah, yeah. And President Obama had a skinny face with big ears. You know, they exaggerate those characteristics that, you know, I guess that some of those subjects might be known for. What we wanted to avoid here was any kind of caricaturization. But what I heard more and more as the month of September wore on, and we thought that it would still be relevant into October, and I believe it will be, is that the mayor has really gotten herself in a hole with everything that's going on. I mean, there's sort of a toxic stew of pressures that are bearing down on her administration. The one that most people are familiar with, of course, is the city's handling and mishandling of the death of Daniel Prude. But there are criminal allegations of campaign finance violations that could very well be coming up in the coming days. And we can talk more about that. There is her increasingly fragile grasp on the Democratic Party in Monroe County as the titular head of it, you know, as the highest ranking elected official before Adam Bello for the last 6 years or so. And then, of course, there's the command structure at RPD literally crumbling overnight. The calls for her resignation have been resounding, and they're mounting.
In this case, I think it's always valuable for myself to continue to remind the listeners that as we discuss what's happening with the mayor, it is a disappointment to me, and I feel like I have disappointed listeners by creating a relationship or at least being part of a relationship with the mayor in which she does not come on this program. I always say that given the fact that she hasn't come on since July of 2017, that listeners ought to hear any analysis maybe with a grain of salt, just in case they think that I sort of have been bothered by that and I'm looking, sort of to score unfair points. I certainly don't view myself that way. I've said from the beginning 3 years ago when she said she would not come back on the program that if she felt she was truly treated unfairly here, then she shouldn't come back. I've tried to repair that relationship. It hasn't worked. And I just want to make sure that that is put out there as we talk about the situation with the mayor. You yourself, I mean, going back to your days of the Democrat and Chronicle, you've had some moments where the mayor has been displeased with you. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, truth be told, we've not spoken in any meaningful way for a couple of years. She took issue with a column I wrote at the Democrat and Chronicle a few years ago that was a riff on the director of GIVA, referring to her as naive. He used the word naive. And I forget the specifics of it, but there was a spat over between City Hall and GIVA over the use of the of Parcel 5 as a performing arts center. And he had called her naive, and she bit back and suggested that it was a sexist remark. And I wrote a column that argued that it wasn't sexist, that naive is sort of gender neutral, if you will. And in fact, I recall actually a week or two before I wrote that column, I think Newsweek had a cover with Donald Trump on the cover that referred to him as naive. So, I think people are entitled to their criticism, especially columnists. That's part of their job is to offer their perspective. They get paid for that, and I did, and she took issue with that. We've not spoken in any meaningful way since. When I say meaningful way, I mean she won't take phone calls or sit for an interview with me, although I have run into her at press conferences mm-hmm. and I've managed to get a question in. She does graciously take those questions, but, she's not been overly available, and sure. People in her administration have not been overly available to me.
As I recall, her argument then was that it's a gendered attack against women that should not be made, the word naive. But she had been on Connections running when she ran for election, re-election. She used that term against another woman in the race.
Is that right?
These things happen. And anyways, so listeners should know that if you want to take any of this with a discount, I don't view what City's cover is as any sort of a personal shot. In fact, as you say, Dave, this is your writing, but you also have a team of people at City that you're working with. I mean, Gino and everyone down the line, they want fair coverage of a very important issue. I'm sure someone would have pulled you aside and said, we're out of line here.
Sure. And I should say that this was vetted in our house here in the City and WXXI family with a number of our colleagues and
sure.
counterparts. I asked for their thoughts on this when it was still just a black and white sort of sketch. And there were very minor criticisms that I didn't think rose to the level of anything that would stop a cover like this. And again, what we're trying to do here is distill and personify or put into an illustration or picture what people are talking about. It's not like we have a picture of the mayor in a hole. they don't come along very often. So you have to illustrate these things. And that's the power of political cartoonists. I mean, one of my favorites, Adam Zyglis over at the Buffalo News, just does a tremendous job. He won a Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago for his work. And they can really sort of capture the zeitgeist and bottle it mm-hmm. up. And that's what we were trying to do with this cover.
Before we really dive into your piece, let me grab Mike in Rochester. I'll take Marie in Fairport in a second. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, hi, Evan. My name's Mike. I live in the greater Rochester area. I listen to your show regularly. I heard your comment about the mayor not wanting to come back on your show. I think you said since July of 2017. I might have gotten the date wrong.
No, that's correct.
I just want to let you know that you are very objective. I hear what you say with people. Often people disagree with others' points of views. But, you know, you're very fair. So if the mayor's not coming on your show, I just want you to know from my perspective, it's nothing that you've done. I don't want you to doubt yourself or to, you know, second guess yourself. I mean, I think she's just a politician, and when people don't agree with her, she'll tend to shy away from those that represent a different point of view, because that's what politicians do.
Mike, I appreciate that. First of all, thank you for taking the time to listen and to call and share your thoughts. I don't necessarily, I mean, you say that you think I come off as objective. I don't think people are objective. People are people. They have biases and ideas. I mean, I think the danger is journalists assuming that they are the only objective people who see the world as it truly is. You know, even Cronkite wasn't that. But I think you have to be aware of your own biases and be very, very careful about that. And then to be gracious and to think that maybe I was wrong. I mean, I listened back to that interview. I had to do it because I had to testify in court recently about that interview, which maybe we'll get to coming up here. There's a few things I'd do differently. I think there's a few things in that interview that I thought were actually kind of unfair. When I asked the mayor, are you under investigation? I think that's an unfair question because I don't know if she could know the answer. And even the insinuation, if she isn't, is sort of dark. And I think that if I had to do it differently again, I wouldn't ask that. I don't think that was fair. And I don't have a problem saying that.
If I were your news director, I would say, Evan, don't be too hard on yourself.
Well, okay,
it's a legitimate question.
Fair. But I'm just saying, you know, when you've got a 52-minute interview, you're going to look back and want to do things differently. On the whole, I thought the interview was fair. And I don't regret pushing the mayor to ask these questions, just as our job is to push any elected leader to answer questions. I mean, we don't do PR for people. If people think it's always a great time talking to Dave Andreotta or Evan Dustin or anybody, then we're just doing PR. But I do appreciate that, Mike, and that's very kind of you. And I think, Dave, there's plenty of elected leaders who maybe view journalists in adversarial terms, but they still take questions and they still, you know, tangle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just had a conversation actually with Bob Duffy, who's no longer an elected official, but, you know, still plays a role in local politics. I mean, I think he's an influential person.
Sure.
In our community. And I hadn't spoke with him in a little while. It had been probably about a year or maybe even more. And somehow it came up in the conversation. I said, I've been known to needle you. And he said, oh, yeah. Yeah, just a bit, just a bit. You know, so
it's remembers.
He remembers, right? It's not forgotten, but you know, I think the one I remember was referring to him along with Danny Wegman and then Assembly Leader, Minority Leader, Majority Leader Joe Morelli as the Masters of the Universe when it came to the photonics issue.
Yeah, and by the way, as you say, I was hard on myself in that interview. I don't think it was probably all that fair for me to ask the mayor if she was under investigation. Turns out she was.
Right.
But that doesn't – I don't think that it fully exonerates the question. I don't think I should have asked it that way. That's really the one I regret. All right. Marie in Fairport next. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I just wanted to compliment City. I just read the first issue of City. Maybe I'm a little behind the times. I enjoyed the issue on Flint, Plex.
Thank you.
And – specifically the Democrats in the Monroe County Legislature. Given that, I think there's been an overrepresentation of city of the city government. This is a city magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And an underrepresentation of Monroe County in the state. I don't know how you get to coverage with a good balance. Because of these things, I rarely listened to WXXI, and I've gone to other public radio stations. So if maybe there's some way, you did cover the Monroe County legislature issue with the Democrats, if you're going to include some of those things, then it is not just the city that you'll be covering. I hope so.
Well, thank you, Marie. I appreciate you reading, and no, you're not far behind. There has only been one print issue of the monthly magazine that came out in September. The stories that you're referencing were the cover story about the vacuum oil company, the Albatross, that is the abandoned vacuum oil company in the Plex neighborhood, Plymouth and Exchange, right on the river, prime real estate, potentially a beautiful neighborhood, and unfortunately saddled with this decaying hulk of a mass on a large brownfield. And you're also referring to a commentary that I wrote about some of the problems in the Democratic Party in Monroe County. But your point is well taken regarding city's focus. I mean, look, we recognize that we potentially have more readers in the suburbs than we do in the actual city. That being said, the city is the engine of our community. And so we try to focus on that as much as we can, but not at the expense of all the suburbs. If there are interesting stories out of the suburbs, we will write about them. As a matter of fact, you know, it's been well documented and well known that I live in one of the suburbs. I live in Fairport, and I wrote about a happening there in this month's issue. So hopefully you'll pick that up.
I cannot wait to talk about that in our second half hour.
Sure, sure. So hopefully, Marie, you'll pick it up and see that we're trying to branch out when and where we can.
Yeah, and at this particular moment, it would be hard to not concentrate on what's happening in the city of Rochester.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, magazines are notorious for having stories done way in advance. You know, you almost have to have a crystal ball about what might be relevant at that time.
Makes it very hard.
Very hard. I mean, The Atlantic just released a story that was to be on its November issue. It released it last week regarding Donald Trump and his potentially not conceding in an election and what could happen. So, you know, they were already at November. They're probably at December or January by now. City's not quite that far ahead. But, you know, our cover this week was to be our annual readers poll, which we're very proud of. People have a lot of fun with it. The Best of Rochester. Well, Best of Rochester is in this issue, and there's a teaser to it on the cover. But to be honest with you, with the turmoil that the city was in, we felt like we couldn't use that as a cover. And that decision was made actually very early on in September that we needed to pivot. And so we went in a different direction.
Rochester is national news right now.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Talking to David Andrietta, the editor of City News. And if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. I want to read that that passage from your piece again, and then I want to talk a little bit about how you sort of perceive what we do know and don't know about this investigation. You write about the Daniel Prude investigation, quote, "It is inconceivable to many that no one in the Warren administration recognized the significance and potential consequences of Prude's death and had a chat with Warren about the implications," end quote. Now, I want to ask you what you think, if you're in your most generous mode with the mayor. In my way of seeing it, the mayor is asking us to believe that the people she hired in her administration, from communications, attorneys, etc., all did terrible things because they thought they should. She didn't know about this. She was not brought into the loop by the police chief about this. And instead of being part of a cover-up, she's asking us to believe that she was just aloof, that she, I mean, it was that the people she hired figured she would want to do all these things. And they just didn't happen to tell her at any point from March to April, to August. And then August 4th, when she did see the video, when Loretta Scott says days later, the mayor told her, Loretta, that this was just a drug overdose and it was a no big deal sort of a thing, that Loretta remembered it wrong. Then when the Rays Commission was convened 6 days later, including former Mayor Bill Johnson, she decided not to tell them because she had other intentions on how to handle this.
Well, I think arguably, though, she would say that she couldn't reveal this publicly. She couldn't talk about it because the state attorney's general's office had jurisdiction over, which the attorney general's office has pointedly rejected.
Yes.
But that was has been her argument.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's not true. But that's the most generous framing I can see of it.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. And, you know, to take it the generosity, if you will, a step further, her deputy mayor, James Smith, compiled this 325-page dossier that includes police reports and criminal reports and Monroe County Medical Examiner's findings and emails that were exchanged between city officials at all levels about the matter. Basically, anything that said Daniel Prude in print got compiled into this huge dossier, and we all have it. Everyone in the media has it, and I think it's been made public at this point. You probably find it anywhere online. And I will say this. Nothing in that document refutes what the mayor is saying.
I agree.
There's nothing.
We don't know that that's a definitive group of documents, but that's true.
Correct. Right. If it is the definitive group of documents, nothing in there refutes what the mayor is saying. There is one possible exception, and that is an email between LaRon Singletary, the former police chief, and her communications director, Justin Roy, who's been suspended unpaid for 30 days. I believe he's still serving that suspension.
He is, yeah.
It was an April 10th email in which the police chief revealed to him that the medical examiner found that the case was a homicide, ruled the case a homicide, Daniel Prude's death. And among the reasons for it, he frankly mischaracterized it.
Obfuscated at the very least, you could say he lied.
Correct.
He basically said resisting arrest was at the top of the list of the ME's findings, which it was not.
Right. The ME's findings were, and I'm going to botch this language, so I apologize. I don't have it right in front
of me. Asphyxiation in the presence of restraint.
Okay. There it is. Hey, it's right in my piece. How about that? Complications of asphyxia in the setting of physical restraint. Right. And that is not resisting arrest.
No, it's not. Okay, and so when the chief says in that same email the mayor's in the loop, he's already lied once in that email.
Right. So he said. Right. I'm sorry. So I should get to the crux of that email. The email says, "Just want to let you know what happened with the ME's office. This is the finding. It found that it was a homicide as a result of." I think he mentioned drugs was one thing. The other thing was resisting arrest. And then it says the mayor has been in the loop on this since day one, March 23rd, which is the day he was arrested, which the mayor has said that she did speak with Chief Singletary that morning after the arrest. She has said that, and that he's waiting for her to call him back. That to me is the biggest question that is still out there. And, you know, the mayor, when she released this 325-page report, she said that she wanted to give – and this was 2 weeks ago now, I believe. She said she wanted to give the media time to digest it and that she would answer questions at a later date. Well, she has answered questions for some media. She sat down on – I think for two interviews.
Two total. This is now 16 days. She promised a new era of accountability and transparency. And she said, you got 300 pages of documents. I'll give you a few days. She didn't take any questions that day.
Correct.
The next day she sits down with Channel 10, the next day with Channel 8, that's it.
Right. So we've not really had a chance. The press corps has not had a chance to really sort of grill her on this. But that is the big question for me. Was that call ever made? And what then was discussed in that phone call if the mayor was to call Chief Singletary back? The other question I have is, you know, what were the text messages that were exchanged between the two? She has referenced that there were text messages exchanged. Those weren't in – copies of those weren't in that 325-page document either.
There is also an exchange that she had with Adam Chodak of WROC-TV during that second interview 2 weeks ago now, in which he pressed her, you know, you never talked to the chief. You met with him 50 times in the last 5 months. He never talked to you about this? And Mayor Warren said, somebody supposedly said that allegedly we had a conversation in an elevator.
I don't know where to begin with that.
I mean, and it's a non-denial denial. I mean, she didn't say, and then so Adam, to his credit, follows up to say, so are you saying that, you know, you didn't have any knowledge? And you know, did you have that conversation? Mm-hmm. And she kind of does. She said, Adam, I assure you, you know, I didn't have the proper information. But she didn't say we never had that conversation. And my point is, you're right, an elevator would not be the setting to have this conversation. But she didn't deny having the conversation with the chief in an elevator. And now it's been 2 weeks and no one's had a chance to ask her to follow up on that.
Sure, sure. And so, you know, why I think it's inconceivable to many that no one in the Warren administration recognized the potential implications of this and didn't have a chat with the mayor is I know from experience that when I call the communications office, she knows about it. She's not in that office, but she's briefed on it almost immediately. And that's not to suggest I have some sort of level of importance in the press corps here. I mean, I suspect that this happens with any reporter who calls.
Yes.
I know that she knows. She prides herself on having her finger on the pulse of what the media asks and wants of her administration. So she's asked her people to keep her in the loop. It's just hard for me to believe that no one, you know, went to her door one day and, Mayor, can we talk about that prude thing? You know, we ought to talk about it.
Especially after George Floyd is killed.
Right.
And seeing that the national response, for Mayor Warren to say that from March 23rd to August 4th, she never saw the tape. And she never asked to see the tape. Someone dies in police custody. The mayor spends the summer saying Rochester is better than most cities. We don't have these issues. She never even said, hey, I know Chief Singletary, you said it was a drug overdose thing, but I also know you got tape. I need to see it.
Yeah.
She never did that? Because if she didn't, is that incompetent to you?
Well, and
I think that raises the question of absolute mismanagement.
Well,
how do you not ask?
Right, and this is why, you know, it is inconceivable to a lot of people.
Yeah,
but I, you know, I'm not ready to say that that she did have those conversations. It's just hard to believe she didn't.
All right, a couple other things on this morning. I know you had Jeremy Mole was there at the news conference at the Police Locust Club. There were attorneys representing the 7 suspended officers. And this is obviously not included in Dave's piece in reporting, but just to kind of get the listeners up to speed on this, what the attorneys are saying is the following. First of all, yes, it was ruled a homicide, but that was a medical declaration, not a legal one.
Okay, that's true.
That is true. Yes.
That is
100%. I don't mean to
true.
Laugh at this.
No.
But of course that's true. I don't think anybody thinks the ME is a judge and a jury. And unfortunately, everybody, just about everybody, understands that the medical experts might say, guys, that's a homicide. But the legal system might say, nah, the cops are fine.
Yeah.
That happens all the time. So for the lawyers to think that that's some sort of a defense.
Right. It essentially means you didn't die either by your own hand or by natural causes. Like something else killed you.
Something else killed
right.
you.
That's
right.
Right.
And listen, I would love to have Matt
person.
Rich and Nobles and these attorneys, I would love to talk to them because I think everybody already knew that. Yes, the homicide ruling was a medical declaration. We don't have a legal declaration yet. And they're going to make the case that, well, the medical experts are wrong on this one. It wasn't a homicide. Okay. They claim that only the officer with his knee on Prude's back or a forearm on Prude's head against the cement would know if Prude was resisting. And the way they described it is, if you were to hold down someone nearby and put your knee on the middle of their back up against the back of their lungs, you would be able to feel if they were trying to push back on you. And so even if we can't see it in the tape and it looks like Prude wasn't resisting, the officer says Prude was resisting, therefore Prude was resisting.
All right. I guess that'll be their argument.
But that means that nobody but the officer can determine if Prude is resisting.
Right. But the other thing that what concerns me about the Prude tape is that I have a serious question as to why the police officers on the scene felt the need to move in anyway. He complied. Look, was he belligerent? Yes. Anyone who's watched this
but
tape.
But almost comically and like deliriously belligerent. Not threateningly belligerent.
Well, correct. And he also didn't have any means to act on any threats that he may have issued. He was naked. You could tell he was unarmed. He was also handcuffed.
Allowed himself to become handcuffed.
Yeah, right. He complied with that. Police moved in after he said, give me your gun. Give me your gun. I want your gun. Something to that effect. Now, I can imagine a police officer's training that says if someone goes after your gun or demands your gun, you have a right to then defend yourself either by restraining that person or however you're going to do it. I can understand that. But there's also a time for context. I mean, he was handcuffed. He wasn't going to get that gun.
No. And PCP wasn't going to make – I mean, I understand that PCP can make someone sort of supercharged and fired up, but there was no indication that was happening. He also – you're right. He was asking for the gun. He was repeating three things. Give me that gun. Then he was making a lewd remark, which I will not repeat on the radio. And then he was saying, in Jesus' name I pray. It was obviously someone who wasn't in a right mind at that moment. It wasn't a direct threat of – you know, the context matters here.
I mean, and moments before, recall that some of the officers were laughing. I mean, this was a comical situation for some of them. They found some humor in it. I mean, he was naked on the ground and, you know, rolling around. I mean, he's not a threat at that point. Yeah. I don't really.
They
understand.
Weren't scared. Going here, get back.
That's what
they're
I'm
laughing
at
the guy,
right? You're not laughing when you're scared.
Two other quick things on that. The attorneys this morning said the quote unquote spit hood was appropriate. One of the attorneys put it on to demonstrate that you could wear it and still see and breathe through it. The issue I have, and I would like to ask them, is you're demonstrating that in a news conference when you know it's coming. Why didn't the officers calmly tell Daniel Prude that's what's going to happen? And when they saw that it scared him and agitated him, did they think, all right, maybe this is not the right move?
Yeah. I mean, I would argue, Evan, you and I might see things a little bit differently on this. I think way too much has been made of the spit hood because it's such a jarring image, especially those still shots,
yeah,
right? What it looks like is a white hood.
Yeah, it does.
It looks like either a plastic bag or some sort of canvas bag. It looks like something you'd put over the head of someone you were going to kidnap, when really it's more of it's like a mesh stocking. It's like it's kind of the mesh you would find in a fish net for an aquarium. You know, very tight little holes that allow you to breathe through it, and obstructs your vision somewhat, but you know, you can still see what's going on. I think that entirely too much has been made of that, but because it's such a jarring image.
Okay, but they also addressed one other point. The attorneys this morning were asked how come they didn't put a blanket around him. They said when someone's on PCP, their internal body temperature goes way up, and that putting a blanket around would not help. In fact, it would be the wrong thing to do there. Mm-hmm. Medically, that may be true. I don't know the answer to that. Again, I would have asked them, should they have at least asked him, are you cold?
Right.
How are you doing? I mean, nobody went up to him and said, hey, I know you're not feeling good right now. We're going to get you out of this. Let's stay calm. We're going to do this together. Are you cold? It's 30 degrees. Do you need some clothes? Do you need a blanket? Nobody even asked.
And in fairness to officers in general, I've seen many show a lot of compassion.
At times.
Yeah.
Sure.
To people in distress, particularly children. I've seen officers really go above and beyond with little ones. But there didn't seem to be a lot of compassion there.
All right. So bottom line, based on your cover story here for City News, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. And I suppose with the four different you referenced four different investigations, we all expect with maybe quicker than many investigations start to get some answers. We don't know.
But that's just on Prude. I mean, remember, they're a campaign finance.
So that's the other thing.
Sure.
Separate to that. The mayor is, we know, there is an investigation, and the DA's office is at least pursuing this in court. And we know this, and this has been publicized now. I was asked to testify based on what the mayor said on the last appearance on this broadcast. I didn't testify against her. I'm not, sort of a witness against the mayor. I was just asked to verify. They wanted to use portions of that program. I think they viewed her appearance on Connections in July of 2017 as a very thorough conversation on the subject. And so I don't know what they did with that. I was in court for about 7 minutes. I come out of the courtroom, and guess what? There's news cameras waiting for me, and that was not a very comfortable day for me. I got to feel what it was like on that side.
You can thank City News for that, because I think we were
the ones who reported.
And the reason we broke it, it wasn't the Evan Dawson is going to testify story. It was we actually know a date.
Yeah.
That was the issue.
Yeah,
that because of our relationship, we share content at WXXI News and City. You were able to tell me I've been called to testify, and you know this is the matter in which I'm testifying in, and now we have a date for it. There had been news reports speculating for some time that prosecutors had been building a case. Now we knew a date, and that's why it became significant news, and that's why then after that story broke the next day, you know, people were outside waiting for you.
All I knew when I testified was that I was not the only one. I don't know who else. I don't know how many. And it is perfectly legal for someone who testifies for a grand jury, as I did, to talk about their testimony. That's fine. Grand jurors can't talk. People who testify can. I'd rather not talk too much about it because it's a little uncomfortable.
Sure.
But let's wrap on that part of the conversation with this. How do you describe to listeners the short version of what they're actually investigating here?
Okay. So they're political candidates are financed by their campaigns, okay? And they have a campaign account, just like a bank account. And that campaign account often has names like paid for by Friends of Lovely Warren. And in this case, that is the name of her campaign account, Friends of Lovely Warren. And that would be used to fund her political ambitions, running for office, whether it be a re-election for mayor, which is actually the race in question, the 2017 race, or any other race she wants to pursue. She had also started a political action committee, and the allegation is that there was illegal coordination between these two committees, in which money was transferred, and there were donations that were supposed to go to the campaign account but went to the political action committee, and it sounds really in the weeds and inside baseball, but the thrust of the argument is that kind of coordination can lead to the evasion of campaign contribution limits. There are limits on what people can donate to a political campaign for good reason, because a guy like, you know, Michael Bloomberg could give, if he wanted to, someone like Lovely Warren $1 billion and, you know, change the course of her entire career. So, of course, there are campaign finance laws that limit how much people can donate. And the thrust of the allegations are that there was a legal coordination that Lovely Warren and her campaign treasurer and the treasurer of that political action committee conspired in a scheme to avoid those limits.
The mayor said that she does think that we need reform of how campaigns are financed when she was on this program, but she said that she is not influenced by money in politics. She thinks other politicians are. Mm-hmm. And she said that the mistakes that were made were not malicious. There was no intent. We will see what happens. Just because there was testimony before grand juries, it doesn't mean that it's imminent that there will be an indictment. But usually when we get to this point, we're not far away. So either this case will get dropped, or we could see an indictment within days here.
Right. What transpires is grand juries sit for a set term. I believe it's 2 to 3 weeks.
I think it's 2 weeks, yeah.
Okay. So your testimony was September 17th. Typically, testimony in any one case doesn't stretch over a number of days. So presumably – and again, I'm saying presumably because grand jury proceedings are secret. You know, my window into this is you. Okay,
yeah.
So presumably they got through the evidence that they needed to get through that day. That was roughly 2 weeks ago. This term we know ends. I believe it's October 2nd, which is tomorrow.
Yep.
That doesn't mean that we're going to find out tomorrow, but it is not unusual for the district attorney's office to release what's called a grand jury rising report. And it tells you the cases in which there were indictments. If there wasn't an indictment, you know, the case won't be listed. And if there is an indictment, it could also be listed as a Jane Doe case or John Doe case. So we may not know, but we should know in the coming days whether it happened.
Okay, that's something to keep an eye on. My guest is David Andrietta, the editor of City News. Michael says, I'm glad to know that we have a journalist in Dave who isn't afraid to take on the mayor and her administration. I've been a city reader since day one. I miss the Towlers, but I'm glad that Dave is the editor. Let's take our only break of the hour. We're going to talk about what else is in this first magazine-style edition. It's once a month. It looks great. The mayor's on the cover, but there's a lot more, and we're going to talk to Dave about that next. Coming up in our second hour, is it time to cancel the remaining presidential debates? It was, well, I'm trying to use my words carefully, an absurd spectacle on Tuesday night, and David Graham, writing for The Atlantic, says it's time to cancel the debates, that the voters aren't gaining anything from this, and it's hurting the country. He'll join us next hour, along with other panelists who have different views about whether the debates offer any value. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'll squeeze in one more listener question on the subject. Jerry just wants to know, has the city settled with the Prude family? No.
No. Not that I know of.
Right. And we do know that there was at least some discussion about that in early August.
Yes.
We don't know the details of if there was an offer or et cetera, but it's beyond that, we don't know, Jerry. It certainly doesn't look like it.
Both sides have acknowledged that there were negotiations.
Okay. So on the subject of your hometown of, well, your now home of, yeah, Fairport, what do you got in the city this month? I'm laughing because this is not funny. I'm just, it's a kind of an amazing story.
Well, thank you. I think it's a really interesting story about perhaps the driest of subjects at first glance. You know, these historical markers, you know, these blue and gold, yeah, ubiquitous historical markers that are everywhere. They were part of a program that New York State, in which New York State handed these things out. It almost seemed like to anyone who had a scintilla of evidence that history, quote unquote, happened here. Between the mid-1920s and the late 1960s. And there was a sign in Fairport on South Main Street denoting a colonial-era home. It was called the Abner White Home. And on that sign, it listed – I'll read it to you exactly what it says. It's put pretty simply, as these signs typically are. Abner White Home, built by Abner White, 1794 – moved here from White Farm across the road. First white child to survive, born here. Abner White is spelled W-I-G-H-T. And when the home was built by Abner White, W-I-G-H-T, and he moved here from across the road at the White Farm, W-I-G-H-T. But the first white child to survive, born here, is W-H-I-T-E. When I first happened upon this sign, I was walking my kids to school, I'm going to say maybe 6 years ago or more. And it had been there since 1949, but, you know, who pays attention to these things? And I happened to see it, and I thought it was a typo. I couldn't wrap my head around why they would be celebrating the first white child born here. I did some perfunctory internet searching, first quote unquote first white child, and found out that first white child signs are an actual thing. Countless of them, hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands, but for sure hundreds.
Across the country
or scattered about the country. There's one on the, I think it's pronounced DuSable or Disable Bridge in Chicago, celebrating the first white child born in Chicago. This is a way that early Americans at one point celebrated their having put down roots.
European Americans,
correct. European Americans, pioneers, we'll call them, settling down and setting down roots and, you know, forever changing the landscape. I mean, certainly there is historical significance there that new people came, settled down, planted roots, and forevermore things were different. And the America we know today would not be this what it is today, for good or bad, for better or worse, had European colonization not taken place. So there is some significance to that event, I suppose, of a community being settled. But the idea of celebrating the birth of that of that first child and denoting them by their race never sat quite well with me.
So when on the subject of race,
mm-hmm.
we know that hundreds of years ago. Well, I mean, look, I am not a race scholar.
Sure,
but the notion of biological race, the notion of whiteness, is in the annals of existence still relatively new.
New,
I mean,
yeah,
like last what? I'm not even going to guess.
I know. I want to say it's like 300 years, and someone's going to call up and say 400, and someone's going to call up and say 150.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay,
you know,
and I would be happy to sort of dig on that separately. The bottom line is this. This is not, these signs were not, first, European colonization, again, good or ill. It was on the subject of race.
Right. And interestingly enough, I mean, these were put up, erected in the early part
That's
of the last century. So
these signs. So they're almost 100 years old?
Well, this one in particular in Fairport is 70 years old.
Okay.
And so I'll finish the story of what happened to the sign. So Fairport had sort of a raucous summer. It had an instance in which racist graffiti was spray painted on an affordable housing complex there. There was a huge state police investigation. The owner of a prominent Fairport business, Fairport Brewing, an employee, I should say, I'm sorry, of Fairport Brewing, took down posters that were pasted up around the village that were sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter movement. There was a march in town, over 200 people, marched through the streets. It was relatively tame, but nevertheless, this was action in this little village and all around the issues of race that didn't quite sit well with people there. And sure enough, the sign has just come down very quietly, but Fairport has said we're removing this sign altogether, and we're going to replace it with something else and with some more sensitive language. I can imagine there being two schools of thoughts on this, and I'm kind of eager to see how the community or readers react to the story.
This might be a seed for a conversation on this program.
Right.
I appreciate that. In the last few minutes, let me just rip through some listener feedback for you. Colby, love your restaurant write-ups. Are you able to do more than one per month?
Yes, we are. You can always find them online, but we'll typically only have one or two in the magazine. This magazine, we didn't have a review of a restaurant. We actually have some news about the godfather of greasy spoons, James Brown. James Brown, we're breaking this news in the city. James Brown is selling his diner, and he's been around for 22
That's
years.
An institution.
He's an institution, and you better get a Kleenex for that one because his fondest memory of it, which I recount in the piece, is a real tearjerker.
Another comment from a listener. Congratulations to City Newspaper. It is great. City News. We are in the middle of a political season, and I see 15-second commercials of what politicians and judges have done. My request to City is to dedicate a column to monthly activity of elected officials. Have they attended the meetings they were supposed to be at? Did they vote? What was their vote? Inform us so we are continuously aware rather than just commercials and postcards the month before an election.
Thank you very much. Duly noted. And you'll find in this edition, we have the election guide of key races, key local races. We couldn't get to all of them, especially at the lower levels, like the village and village level and that sort of thing. But most of the key races you'll find broken down, and as well as other election news.
Steven says, do we know for a fact that Daniel Prude was on PCP?
Yes, the medical examiner found traces of it in his body.
Yeah, and I'd have to talk to a medical examiner to ascertain how much. I mean, was it a heavy dose? I don't know exactly. I also know that the notion of excited delirium, Gary Craig in the Democrat and Chronicle wrote a really good review of you're looking at me like you're really going to praise the DNC.
Oh, no,
we love our colleagues.
No. I agree with you.
Did I miss? Oh boy, what did I miss?
No, we touched on that in City on actually day one, but Gary Craig went far more in depth. So fair enough. No.
The bottom line is that excited delirium is sometimes used too much as a catch-all.
Yeah,
and isn't necessarily a medical term, and we've got to be very careful about just assuming. Well, excited delirium, he could have done anything. It's not quite that way, and we got to be very, very careful with that.
Yeah, its use is controversial.
About 40 seconds left here. What else is on the horizon for City that you're looking forward to?
Oh, boy. Well, I would just encourage everyone to pick up City. You know, it's funny because I'm looking at a proof of the magazine here because our circulation manager, Kate Stathis, who does a wonderful job for us, got a flat tire on her way here and couldn't deliver the magazine to the office.
Is that why
I have enormous the giant proof. But the magazine is on newsstands right now. So I'm looking forward to picking up a copy, and I hope your listeners are too.
I appreciate this. Thanks for coming on.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Where will people find the physical copies?
Oh, gosh. Anywhere they used to pick up City.
That's
but there are
the,
over
that,
500,
that's the most important.
Yeah, there are over 500 locations. The most common for most people are Wegmans.
Okay, but the bottom line is where you used to find City, that's where you find City.
It should be there. In some cases, because of the pandemic, some places removed their racks. We weren't printing, and we're still working out some of those kinks. But for the most part, they should be there.
I know you got nothing to do today, so I'm glad to give you something to do. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Evan.
David Andrietta is the editor of City News. Looks great, by the way. More connections coming up.